Good night, everyone. Welcome to In, a series of live online conversations with practitioners in the visual arts presented by New Local Space. In is broadcasted from audio production house Creative Sounds in Kingston, Jamaica. NLS's 2014 programming is made possible with support from Creative Sounds Limited, Transformer Washington, D.C., and Alice Yard, a contemporary art space and network based in Port of Spain, Trinidad and Tobago. Tonight, we air the second in a series of live conversations between the group of artists exhibiting work with NLS and ARC magazine at Emerge Art Fair in Washington, D.C. next week. I'm Deborah Anzinger, and tonight I'm moderating a conversation between James Cooper, Stephanie Cormier, and Ian DeLeon. I'm going to give you a little background on our guests. James Cooper was born in Bermuda in 1965 and went to university in British Columbia, Canada, where he studied landscape architecture. He was a pro athlete, triathlon, in his early 20s, where he represented Bermuda at a few world championships. His introduction to photography was primarily commercial, as he owned a production company and produced all sorts of fashion and editorial shoots for US and European clients in Bermuda. Bermuda is a key part of his work, which consists largely of underwater photography. However, Cooper's work isn't about documenting aquatic life in picturesque waters. Instead, he depicts people in water accompanied by surreal props like horse masks, spray paint cans, or bright strings. Stephanie Cormier was born in Montreal, Canada, grew up in Barbados, and has since lived in the UK and Toronto, where she currently resides. Stephanie completed her BFA at OCADU Toronto and holds an MFA from the University of Guelph, Ontario. Her work has been exhibited across Canada as well as internationally. She has earned several national grants and awards, and her work can be found in the Carte Blanche Photographers Book 1. Ian DeLeon's work is a personal journey of familial and cultural discovery with societal implications that highlight lingering narratives within popular culture that seek to exoticize, romanticize, or apologize for colonialism in all of its forms. By means of video, the internet, performance, text, ready-made sculpture, recycled materials, education, and activism, he strives to take these messages and subvert them, recontextualize them, creating symbols that encourage new narratives and individual reflection on the systems of power that extend oppression and domination into the 21st century. We have a really diverse range of approaches here tonight, in terms of you and your artistic practices, and we got the conversation. This conversation began before this broadcast, and I know James, you have some thoughts on qualities that the work from each of you shares. Do you want to go ahead and start with that?
Sure, Deborah, you're very good. That's very professional. I would say a couple things. First of all, I'm going to apologize for my bio. It's a little bit old. I don't only shoot stuff underwater, so I've moved on from that. And anyway, it's interesting you say that it's very diverse. I don't think our work's that diverse. It's different, but there are definitely qualities that are similar. And I think there's a, to me, what I really like about all of our work is there's a certain amount of risk-taking there. And some of the risk-taking that I see is like the courage to be kind of what I call low tech, and it's actually not an easy thing to do. In my own work, sometimes I really think, oh gosh, it should be more, you know, dynamic, it should be more worked out, but like instinctively I pull away from that. And I'm just curious, I mean, the pictures that I selected from both Ian and Sophie were like, Ian, you were chewing that. Your work's a little harder to talk about because it's performance based. So it's like I'm only seeing pictures of it. But I see a quality in there that I guess goes to that low techness of it. And I'm just curious if that's something that what you think about that in your work. I mean, is that a big concern to you or?
Yeah, I think for me, it certainly has an element of being an ecological preoccupation. And also very practically the result of being extremely indebted as a result from going to art school. But I think primarily there's a conscious choice on my part to eschew perfection as a reaction to what you brought up in our earlier conversation about the hyper-commercial, hyper-packaged world, you know, late capitalist market. And for me, it's important in light of this to promote the unfinished, the fluid, or the scattered in a way that for me evokes the writings of some folks that I've been getting really into a lot recently, especially Glissant. And I really want to make this kind of continuation, this parallel flow between creative energies and my thoughts and how I identify and my artwork. So
right.
Now I'm trying to bridge those things.
Yeah, I'm also seeing more, as I spend more time with your work, both of you, I'm seeing more similarities. And to go along with the not wanting that perfection, and I think we're all involved in process a lot. And I'm really drawn to materials and objects that seem to have lived a life and been through something.
Right.
And I've recently been investigating the ontology of objects and the fact that looking at things as something that's how you would normally look at organic things, so things evolving, and how, so then you think of time and entropy. So I'm interested in that dichotomy that all matter has a life because all matter decays, but at the same time we're in this world and in this life that is sort of infinite and will continue. So I enjoy that dichotomy and
right.
Yeah, just being attracted to things that seem to have lived through something.
Yeah, that really resonates for me. Sorry, James, you were going to say.
No, I was just saying, I mean, it just felt that I think I totally agree with both of you, but the when you approach a show like something like Emerge, is that how do you gel those kind of feelings with, okay, I got to have three objects in this funny room in Washington, D.C. I mean, is that difficult for you to come to terms with that, or just like it's just one part of the much bigger thing that's your life and it's not a big deal?
Hmm.
I'll ask and answer the questions at the same time.
I was going to say initially in response to the stuff Stephanie was bringing up, that like organic, the idea of the organic, of the fluid, of things being dynamic and changing, I really embrace that in my work, which often includes an organic component, sometimes a completely organic component, which does bring up issues sometimes in exhibition situations. And you know, there's often a worry with my work, like, oh, how long is this thing going to last before it rots and flies come out of it or get attracted to it, or this kind of thing. For Emerge, you know, nothing as extreme as that is in play for me. But okay. I think my work already is the kind of difficult organic material to digest for your standard art fair viewing crowd, and I think there will be an element of that aversion to the organic, even if it's immaterial that won't decompose in our lifetime.
But yeah, or it's like I guess Stephanie was saying earlier, or in some of the emails, it's, or they have to live as something else. I mean, you know, it lives as a photograph or a video, or you know, there's ways of displaying it. But the core of what you're doing is, I think your work's amazing. It's really brave. You know, I when I look at it, I think, wow, that's freaking pretty awesome. And but it is. But that's what's exciting about work like that, is that, you know, where does it fit into shows and, you know, whatever. And maybe it's, I don't know. But I think that, and going back to what Deborah had said originally, I think there are actually more and more similarities. I mean, when I hear Stephanie talking about, you know, her organic and you using organic materials, and to me, it's not super conscious, but like if I look through all my works, like, yeah, there's definitely a theme of land and nature. And I also wrestle with this idea of permanence and impermanence in a lot of the sculptures I'm making. And it's exciting to me. And I think I said it in an email or saying to Holly, is like this idea that it's actually happening right now, and that it's evolving as you're looking at it, is something that's really important to my work anyway.
I want to interject something right there. I think one of something that I see between all of you is that though you're working in different, you're diverse in media. You know, Ian works a lot in performance. Stephanie is a lot in sculpture and painting, and you, James, are a lot in like photography. Though you may be using, say, you're low tech. You know, there's definitely a contemporary aesthetic to the way that you crop your photographs and the way that you collage them. And but what I really see between the three of you is this embracing of unknown in your practice, which I think Stephanie had mentioned earlier was, I think she called it a less didactic approach. But with Ian, I don't know if I would go as far as saying it is less didactic for Ian in terms of the approach, because Ian, you seem to have very clear political points of view that you are you're targeting. And I want to know a little bit about how I guess you balance, because performance definitely inherently has a lot of the unknown in it, because you know, for it to be what we generally consider to be performance art, is going to be less theatrical, and it's going to be pretty organic in the way it kind of unfolds, even though you may have some kind of structure. I want to know how you balance the two in your practice, in terms of embracing the unknown of performance, but yet having such targeted political views in your work.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the focus in a lot of my pieces is clear in the sense that I may be addressing a specific culture, a societal ill, a victim of oppression, some law, something like this. But my point of view, I hope, is still as ambiguous as you might find in a more abstract work of art, because I am so committed to this idea of fluidity and non-essentialism, you know, not really being didactic to the extent that I'm negating one thing over another. So very much being conscious of this fluidity while wanting to address specific issues, that for sure. And then, I mean, with performance, I've dabbled with varying levels of success, the amount to which I want to didactically address the audience, and I think the success of those performances is really just dependent on the audience, where they're at, like how ready they are to sit through something that may contain a lot more information than they're expecting from a typical avant-garde performance that, you know, a lot of people kind of generally summarize as being durational, involving something messy, silent on the part of the artist, just using the body. I certainly use those things, but I think I need to have a balance in my work, and I try to inject different levels of information. Because in the end, my performance goes hand in hand with what I do in other parts of my life. You know, teaching, activism, organizing, and making artwork. To me, that's all related. So they all intertwine, intersect.
Mm-hmm. If I can interject here, I think originally when I had brought the question up, I talked about how do you let the world come into your work, and I think Ian, you have a perfect balance for this, because you have the concept, the idea, and for lack of a better word, the script that you're going to perform, but because you're doing it live and in the manner that you do it, anything can happen. It's sort of this raw, live thing that you never know how it's going to turn out.
Right.
And I also brought up what I thought and I think Deborah mentioned this, the unknown, and I also look at it as, in my works, the hypothetical or the untested, and creating things that are maybe absurd or fantastical. And I kind of see this as also somewhat liberating, because you sort of turn things on their head and you allow this freedom and you allow this fresh perspective through just proposing something completely irrational and absurd.
Right, absolutely. Which is something I see in a lot of James's work as well, where the absurd plays into it, certainly, and I see a level of commentary about, you know, your day-to-day surroundings, James, right. About the Caribbean, about, you know, different ideas about paradise, representations of the Caribbean, and yeah, I think you aren't didactic about it, right?
I would pick up on something you said a little bit earlier, Ian, is that you can, and it's not a new idea. I mean, but it's very hard to separate your own life from your artwork. So like, you have to be willing to take chances in your own life. You have to be willing to be a little absurd or whatever the thing is, and then that perhaps will be reflected in your artwork. And these are things like just on less an artistic level, but a personal level. I do enjoy humor in people. I do enjoy people who are intelligent and look at things a little bit differently. I mean, I think that is the way forward in, you know, art and a lot of things. So I can't remember what the question was. What was your question?
The performative moment, I guess.
But also speaking to the unknown and sort of just turning things on their head.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And I think we're all very conscious of that. And just by looking at our work, it's like you. I think it's very difficult or a slippery slope to go down to try and make art that's going to have one type of reaction to it. So the idea that what's important, and I think I've said this maybe before, is like when I look at you guys' art, it's like, what you look at is like, what's really important is to ask questions, and it's not questions that need an immediate answer. So it's like, that's art, and that's why I'm in it. That's what it appeals to me. I mean, there's a million paths and whatever in your life, but I actually have a question for you, Ian. And it's I haven't seen any of your performances, and I don't know if I find a lot of, like, I look at you, they're all mildly violent, which is kind of surprising to me. Like,
towards myself.
Like, they seem like, yeah, and or just in, yeah, towards yourself, for sure. And what is it like to see you? Is it a difficult thing to watch one of your performances, do you think, in that regard, or is it uncomfortable?
I've certainly heard from other people that some of them are hard to watch, especially the one that you chose, James, which involves chewing through like seven pieces of.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great image, even as a still image. But
yeah.
Why chewing through seven pieces of what?
Can you tell us some more about that performance, Ian? Just give us a blow by blow.
Yeah.
Of what happened.
It was in March this year for Metanoia, an exhibition related to Volta that Arc Magazine curated. We were at Gray Space in New York. A great space there, and I was continuing this thread in my work that involved exploring agriculture as part and parcel of colonial domination that is extended into today. And I mean, what better kind of visual for that than sugar? And I was really interested in bringing the cane into focus, something that at least in the U.S., a lot of people are disconnected from, case in point being that people couldn't tell if I was holding a bamboo stick or a tiki torch on the MTA on my way to the space. But in any case, I was interested in evoking this sense that in order to free ourselves in the Caribbean from these colonial legacies, it might really be necessary to kind of start from zero almost. One example of that could be the negation of the sugarcane production in general. So I started with this idea that I used Kafka's Metamorphosis as a kind of visual reference for, and I wanted to evoke the sense of me being this insect that is as a slowly devouring and taking down this metaphorical cane field, you know, standing
a parasitic insect,
like a parasite, yeah, that would bore into it and just destroy it from the root and
I mean, this is not really related to your thing, but how long does it take to chew through a piece of sugar cane?
One after the other like that, you know,
yeah.
It starts
to get longer and longer.
In total, about 2 hours for that particular time. Not something I'll be doing again, though.
No, you can't.
But in general,
that'll be the one that they love the most. You'll be asked to do that all over the world for the rest of your life.
I hope not. No, but for me, it was really about bringing people really to consider where this thing historically and biologically comes from that we eat excessive amounts of, especially in the U.S. You know, this thing is something we really need to talk about because oppression related to it is not over, despite what current sculptural representations of sugar might lead you to believe. It's still happening. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I'll leave that alone as well.
Maybe I'll kind of change direction here, because I think we sort of touched on it. I think maybe both of you, but I think maybe James mentioned it, something about the idea of having this sort of survivalist instinct and sort of just making do with what the materials and the things that are around you, and not sort of, like, I made a conscious effort in my last body of work to not go to an art store. Everything that I used was something that I could find in the house. So I think that's something that maybe some of both of you guys can relate to, and just sort of using stuff at hand.
Without a doubt. I mean, the picture I sent, that tapestry that was the plastic and stuff, Stephanie.
Mm-hmm.
Is that more recent as well? Hello?
Hello, Stephanie?
We're losing Stephanie in and out. But I can answer her question just from my...
Use tape.
She's back.
Okay.
Stephanie, you chipped out. You chipped out for a second there. Do you have something to elaborate on in your question?
No, I was talking about using materials at hand. Did you hear all of that?
Yeah, we heard all of that.
I can answer to some of that. It's back to this my thing I like. I mean, and it's where artists, you know, we're also human beings, right? So there's other things that happen in our lives. And I think, Stephanie, you have a young daughter, or I think a daughter, I'm not sure. But, like, for me, I have young kids now. And so, like, my world has shrunk in, like, the craziest way. Like, so I don't really go... And it's a positive thing for me. It's like, so I've been forced to make work in a much smaller scale than I used to. And I actually go back and, like you say, find stuff in your house. I've been recycling a lot of photographs that I took, you know, years ago, and then trying to rework them. And it's taken me on a whole another tangent. And I think, and working in the Caribbean is something, again, materials wise is. It's just a different. It's not a negative thing. It's just a different thing. It's like, literally. I mean, if I go to Art Store Rita, there's some tape, maybe some craft paper, nothing, right? So it's not like living in a city where you can go and get whatever you want when you have that decision. So I guess, you know, you become resourceful out of necessity, really. So
I think it's a really great. I think that was a very, very good question and point that Stephanie touched on, because I think even though it may be more dramatic or exacerbated in the Caribbean, I think, you know, a lot of people speak about these shrinking economies, do you think that perhaps this kind of working method might be a reflection of the reality that we're dealing with globally, you know, you taking that kind of approach to materials and, as you say, this sort of survivalist approach? Do you think that maybe there's a larger implication beyond your creative practices to the current reality that we're living in, not just artists? Mm-hmm. Does anybody want to speak about that?
I guess I'll just mention something quickly first. I think I was very aware when I went back to school recently and I was commuting, and I was very aware of my daily journey and the things that I would carry and take with me, and this reminds me a bit of your work, James, with things strapped and taped to you, which actually reminds me very much of Canadian artist Raphael Dubreuil, who does similar stuff, and just talking about the burden of material things and objects, but also as visual artists, just them being part of our lives and being drawn to them as well. So for me, it became very much about this traveling I was doing every day, and like you, having a young daughter and just sort of having to do things really quickly and be really resourceful. And I think there we all do feel a responsibility now to you know, use what we have and make do
I would say I'm a little bit different than that, and like I would like to think that's the reason I do it, but I also know myself. I am, the way my mind works, I do work really quickly. I have a lot of ideas, you know, every day, and so to me it really is it makes sense for me to work with stuff that's just around me rather than to spend a whole lot of time. And if I have a hard time talking about this, I think there's a lack of craftsmanship that almost annoys me in my work, but it's just the way my mind works. So, and I think I know I have friends in Bermuda who are no wealthier than I am, who make incredibly detailed work that's you know, I don't think it's really necessarily a reflection of our time as much as of my personality from my perspective.
James, why do you? I have a quick question here. Why do you say that it annoys you, that there's a lack of craftsmanship in your work that sort of annoys you? Do you think that that's a reflection of the space of the space that you occupy culturally, in terms of the culture of Bermuda and maybe the Caribbean at large? Why do you?
No, I shouldn't say it annoys me. What something I wrestle with a little bit is like I can be quite. I don't know what the word is, like it kind of not flippant, but like to me it's like I think I could make things that appeal to myself even more if I took more time sometimes. So, and I think I'll go there. I mean, it's like, it's a lifelong process, right? So I'm not, but I see things in my mind that I know I want to do, and it's like I'm not quite doing it yet, and some of it's because I'm rushing through things, I think.
I have
like therapy for me. Thank you very much.
Ian, you had a question, and then I'll chime in with a question that Holly sent in. But go ahead, okay. Ian.
Just something really quick for Stephanie. Like, I'm definitely seeing this relationship to everyday objects in your work as well as with James. But whereas I feel with James, there's this intentional leaving or even kind of focusing on the brandness of an object that he's using, drawing attention to the commercial aspects to it. I feel like your use of everyday objects totally destroys like the brand, the company that it originally relates to, and it becomes actually like this really organic like form, organic in the sense of resembling corals or rock formations, stuff like this. So yeah, could you talk a little bit about your relationship to transforming materials and removing them from like the commercial sphere?
Sure. I mean, I think I'm interested in making the familiar unfamiliar, and changing the function and meaning of objects. And I mentioned at the beginning my recent investigation into the ontology of objects. And I've been reading a lot about neo-materialism. So just the idea that a product can take on more of a life force. Are you guys hearing me?
Yeah. Mesmerized.
Okay. I'm not sure how to elaborate on that, but that's my first thought.
Maybe I just want my work to look more like Stephanie's. But frustrating. That I'm not changing it.
Oh my gosh. I have a question from Holly James for you. One of the concerns, she says, that you keep reiterating in your process and production of images involves the slowing down of observation. So in many ways, making work that is contrary to how we are going about experiencing most of the world. What elements in your photographic practice are you deliberately including to ensure that this pause reveals something greater about the content and form of your work?
All right. Okay. Kind of what I was talking about, and it's an idea that I've been having, and it's whether my work's that is going that way, whether it's that successful right now as an answer to that question, I'm not sure, but I have this, I've always kind of been into this idea of like altered states and like just the way you can change your, not necessarily consciousness, but just your experience. And you can do that any number of ways, but most of those ways are really through sort of an agitated state. And I was thinking, what's really the most radical thing in the world today is actually being really relaxed, because everything in the world is like hyping you up. So I was thinking, as an artist, maybe it's interesting to like try and attain a level of complete like relaxation. And so I'm also drawn to minimalism in general. So like to me, it has to do with the images themselves. And I'm actually getting into cutting out a lot of the subject matter of my pictures, and it also has to do with how they're displayed, and I'm still really wrestling with that, but the core of that idea to me is this idea of slowing down, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Take that. The conversation stopper right there. There you go.
I see that, yeah.
This is me personally, right? So like, I sometimes feel like when you talk about your work, it's like, I feel like I want to say, like, there's a million ways to make art. There's a million different paths in life in general. So, like, this is me, what I'm interested in. I'm not saying that this is the way the whole world should go, right? And I think what Stephanie was saying before, too, I mean, Sophie was saying this, that, you know, you can't control everything. So, and it really, what you really can't control is how someone reacts to your work. So, you have to do what's makes sense to you and have the courage to do that. And at the same time, what's important in some ways is it's important how they react to your work when they see it, but there's also a huge component, I think, and I think as a performance artist, Ian, you would vibe on this, is how do you then react to your regular life having seen that performance? So it's not necessarily, you don't have to react to that performance at that time, but then having been in that gallery and seen Stephanie's work,
right?
How do you go back to your own reality? I mean, that's the big interesting shift in art to me.
Mm-hmm. Ian, can you speak a little bit about about what James is referring to in his work? He refers to the audience and the audience interpreting the work, but for a performance artist that is more visceral or immediate. And we touched on it a little bit. How do you find there's where do most of your performances take place? Do they take place within most of them take place within a Caribbean context where they would understand the sugarcane, or do most of your performances happen outside of the Caribbean? How do you wrestle with interpretation of the audience, and how have you found the audience to receive your work outside of the Caribbean? There are a lot of questions in that.
Yes. I think okay. And so, first off, I've only just this past month performed live in the Caribbean for the first time, and even then it was a series of intimate performances in Martinique where it was really just me and a friend who's helping me document the experience. Not for any particular reason, just practically, that's how it turned out. Because it's the first opportunity I've had to do something like that in the Caribbean. So that being said, the majority of my work thus far has taken place in the United States, or this summer in Berlin for a couple of performances. And in any case, they're often removed from a Caribbean context. Even if there is a pretty strong diaspora element. I find that in the U.S., I'm often dealing with either a total ignorance of the issue in question, or there's an issue also of diasporic amnesia, which I think translates either into this sort of rapid assimilation into a conservative American point of view upon immigration, or this kind of conservative feeling that, that an émigré brings with them upon being exiled, you know, from their homeland, something that being a Cuban American, I can see a lot of in my family and my, my hometown, Miami. So,
so then how is the work generally received by and with the, within this context of amnesia, as you call it?
Sometimes the work is received very aggressively. Sometimes it is completely new. Everything I talked about is completely new to an audience. And those are things that, those are both things that I'm looking for, I think, in my performances, to both educate and learn, as well as to instigate or to activate some kind of dormant, latent assimilation or a conservative viewpoint that I feel is problematic and perpetrating some things. So for me, the performances that, that I've done so far have been very specifically for an audience who may not be familiar with the themes that I'm talking about or has forgotten them historically, and I'm interested in reactivating those moments and bringing up that conversation again, which is why when I was in Martinique this past week, the performances were different. They took on a different tone, and I didn't feel ready to perform in front of an audience just yet, because I knew that the Caribbean context would be totally different from my U.S. experience. I wasn't dealing with the issue necessarily of forgetting or not knowing, because those things were all too present in a Caribbean reality.
Mm-hmm. So what can you give? What, how was it received here in the Caribbean?
I don't mind. The work that I did show so far has been received very well. I think it was seen as this form of kind of diasporic solidarity, which I'm very proud to have it be received that way. And to talk a little bit about what I got from this experience recently of drawing and making work from the Caribbean context in Martinique and right now in Puerto Rico where I am, I get from this setting a feeling that a reminder that I must embrace kind of complexity and fluidity in my work, especially when I'm addressing this particular context, because things in the U.S. operate very differently. You know, race, class, and gender operate in a way that I would almost describe as more classical. You know, more kind of hardcore, segregated, racist, nasty. Even though North Americans don't like to admit this, but in the Caribbean, I found that it was much more about intersectionality, contradiction, and you could find varying problematic aspects of race, class, and gender happening on every level of society with every kind of variant within the individual. So it's a lot more difficult to tackle.
So would you say, is this something that has started cropping up in your work yet, or is it still those kinds of observations still have they not been, I don't know if you're still in the process mentally of assimilating that into your, I don't know how much exposure you've had in the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. Is this something that is in your work currently, or is this something you're still contemplating? And also, go ahead.
No, I just say that I hope that it is in there thus far. And thinking back on some specific pieces, I would say it is. I mean, there's some very literal readings of some of my work, especially like the work in Emerge, which features two Polaroid images of Fidel Castro. in the Cuban American community of Miami, they're either gonna read it as abominable that I even deigned to reprint or reproduce Castro's face, or it will be seen positively in that I am ridiculing some aspect of him. And actually, my
These are re-photographs
of of Polaroids of Castro taking a Polaroid. It's very.
Yeah, I saw the picture. I just wasn't sure what the re-photographs of photograph.
Yeah, but but if someone were to have a conversation with me personally about my beliefs on the matter, you know, it's much more. I have a much more diverse and complex view of the whole revolution than my family does. For example, right. I am not condemning the revolution, nor am I absolutely supportive of Castro's policies. And, you know, someone, a good friend that I just made, shout out to Ricardo in Martinique, he said it perfectly, you know, I am a supporter, I supported the revolution, but I don't like Castro. And those complexities are something that are sometimes hard to express in the diaspora community in the U.S., yeah. But something that I feel like is way more approachable in the Caribbean context.
Mm-hmm. And I would say, I mean, this is where I'm going to go a little bit further out.
Wait,
there.
Can I interject just 1 minute? And then I want you guys to each tell the... First of all, I want to encourage the audience to send questions in. And then
there's
I also want
there is
you...
An audience,
yeah, there is an audience. And I also want to send us questions in via Twitter. Or if you're feeling shy, just private message us on Facebook. But what I wanted you guys to do here is to share the links to your website so that people could maybe look at the work while they're listening to the podcast. Can you just go ahead and just give us the links, the URL?
Who's going first?
Starting with James.
Yeah, the best place to see my work is I put it on a Tumblr site, and it's at Atlantic, like the ocean, Atlantic Juice, at how's it work? .tumblr.com. No,
Atlantic Juice.
I can't remember. AtlanticJuice.tumblr, and there's no e on Tumblr.com. T-U-M-B-L-R. And that's I update that the most for sure. So.
Okay, and then Stephanie.
Mine's fairly simple. It's just my name.com. So that's Stephanie, Stephanie Cormier, Cormier.com.
Ian?
And I have iandeleon.com. No accent on the De Leon for the website, just iandeleon.com. And then I frequently update a Tumblr, iandeleonarts.tumblr.com.
And James, you had a question. Can you just go right ahead and
ask?
I have a question too. If you can't think. Okay,
go ahead, Stephanie.
Ian keeps bringing up the word fluidity. So I kind of wanted. I know that Ian, you might have had a question for me about that, but I sort of want to. We can talk about how my thoughts on this word, but I just wonder. Your idea of fluidity, what exactly do you mean?
Both visually kind of evoking a liquid or mutable state of being in flux, and also, I guess, like philosophically, just being in a position to accept change, to go with the flow, for lack of a better word.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I think you were asking me about my materials and the fact that...
When I was looking through your website, I couldn't get over the sense that I really wanted to touch the artwork, you know? Mm-hmm. And I in my mind, described them as soft. Mm-hmm. And I really just pictured, tried to imagine exactly how they would feel, and I'd went on like that for a long time. So I was interested if you saw your work in relation to or opposition to other artists who kind of either work with the soft or like to evoke the soft with contradictory materials. And I was thinking of folks like Clyce Oldenburg or Linda Benglis.
Right.
But yeah, just what are your thoughts on that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think of my work as soft sculpture necessarily. Well, I am doing a lot of these curtain or quilt-like things. But a lot of the work you're probably talking about is stuff, probably a lot of it is the polyurethane foam sculpture.
Yes.
And I don't really think of the work as soft, fluid, definitely. Actually, a lot of them are quite static, but they depict movement and they depict change, and I kind of look at them as things that were sort of, I talk about collaborating with objects, so this thing that I did together with the object, and we came up with this thing together. So so the process is kind of performative in making these. I have looked at Linda Benglis quite a bit. Oldenburg, maybe a little, not so much, but I think I do appreciate when, especially Linda Benglis in her early work, it was sort of like this movement against or this opposition to what came before, which was a lot of modernist sculpture, some minimalist and very sort of modular stuff. Very, yeah.
I think whereas she might visually even like represent a moment of movement, like a sculpture that looks like something flowing or oozing, even though yours might not necessarily look that way, as you said, I totally see the remnants of time in it. I see the like performative aspect to the creation, and there's like this geological aspect to it that makes me think of layers and time and sediment. So yeah.
I really like those too. And the I like. Hello.
Go ahead.
I know. I think they're great. And there's something really captivating about an object too, as opposed to just something flat on a wall. And I think it's the ones I really liked are the big white. I don't know what you called it. The big white one where you've actually layered stuff inside and then cut it in half.
Right. Yeah. A lot of the smaller objects, which I call the anthropocentric specimens, are sort of speculative in that I look at them as sort of futuristic sort of fossils or something.
What are you going to have those? What is going to be in at Emerge? Those objects?
Yeah, some of the smaller objects, some of the specimens are going to be there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to ask Stephanie a little bit more about her influences. So yeah, the work is, I think we can all agree, whether or not it's soft or whether they're hard, I think we can all agree that they're very materially tactile, and your palette is very playful. I think of Jessica Stockholder's, some of Jessica Stockholder's work when I see yours, especially use of things that aren't considered traditionally art materials. Is she one of your influences? If not, can you speak a little bit more about the artists that you think were formative for you?
Okay. Yes, I've definitely looked at Jessica Stockholder. I think of a lot of sculptors and painters have. I think also, you would think the obvious influence is the color and maybe the found objects and materials, but she's also quite involved. Her work does have a narrative to it that I think I'm more drawn to. Like I said before, she sort of shuts down the meaning of objects and making the familiar unfamiliar. So she opens up a whole, once you shut down one meaning, you open up, a million more meanings.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, there is the element of narrative that she opens up.
Mm-hmm.
As far as other influences, I think mine are very, really varied. In the last few years, I've been looking at a lot of Ligia Clark. I don't know.
Yeah, I really from Brazilian. She was a Brazilian artist.
Yeah. And then I've been looking at, recently, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the G's Bend Quilters from Alabama.
No.
They're a group of African-American women that made quilts basically
yes.
out of scraps, and mostly in the 60s and 70s, I believe, but it still does exist to a small extent. So I have a really varied set of influences that I look at. But a lot of them are involved with material, connecting with material bodies, and yeah, as I said, I mentioned Ligia Clark and her.
How are you pronouncing her first name? Ligia.
Ligia. L-Y-G-I-A.
Yeah. I think Ian. She might be a. I don't know if you've heard of her before, but
yeah.
You might be interested in her.
Yeah, definitely. And I was just going to say, I really do love this narrative quality in your work that I think, for me, sets it apart from work that might look similar that I would be less interested in, you know, something that would give me just, like, an untitled number 1 through 47 or something like that. And, like, case in point, the image that I selected of your work that I really appreciated has this great title, Tool to Plant Flowers in Your Uterus.
Right.
And just from that, I could tell that you were thinking not only about materials and formal aspects, but you were doing other things with it and telling stories for sure.
Yeah, definitely. That's sort of something that I do to sort of research and development. I get a lot out of writing and that sort of speculative element.
Yeah, another thing I noticed in your work, and it's something I think you hear a lot of when people talk about the Caribbean in general, is like, oh, that these are Caribbean colors. I actually don't think they're Caribbean colors. Like, a lot of these kind of, they're unnatural colors, and to me, it's like they're human colors, because human beings are the only ones that create these things. So when you combine these colors with organic or natural elements, there's something really magical happens, and it's I think it's.
Well, I look at it as, I mean, few people have mentioned, oh, you know, because you grew up in the Caribbean, does that influence your palette? But a lot of my recent work has been purposely using synthetic materials that have been, you know, dyes that have been mixed in a factory, and I'm interested in that because I'm interested in how these things will decay and how our influence of making things will eventually erode into the earth and mix with the earth, so the human products are mixing with natural products and will all eventually become this one conglomerate of, you know, we're slowly merging, materials are merging and together. So I'm definitely interested in merging natural with synthetic.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Maybe I can use this as a segue for my question to James, which is about how your work, as I saw it, dealt with the lived experience of being in the Caribbean and the impact of tourism or exterior representations of the Caribbean as this quote unquote paradisical place. You know.
Yeah. I mean that it is. I mean I can't deny that that's part of. I do think about that and but it's not. It's a It's also symptomatic of living in the where I am. So I mean that is what's around me. But there's a book, I don't know if either one of you read, it's called Consuming the Caribbean, by Mimi Scheller. Have you ever read that?
No.
That's a freaking awesome book. And one of the main points she makes, many points, is, I mean, the whole landscape of the Caribbean is so loaded as far as just it's been so used for all these purposes of like this idea of fantasy and Gardens of Eden, and it's all this, everyone's outside vision of the aesthetic of the Caribbean, and so a lot of what you're seeing in contemporary Caribbean art is just is actually people who are inside that trying to say, okay, let's look at it for what it really is.
Yeah, that's not all it is.
Yeah, uh-huh. and
I'm always struck when I go back there as how things are worn down and washed out, and the elements have really attacked it.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
You know, I just want to, part of this is a statement, part of this is a question. Stephanie mentioned, you know, shutting down the meaning, what you think of as the inherent meaning in an object, shutting that down, and in doing that, opening a whole set of other possible meanings and interpretations. Right. And I see that in your work, James. I actually think that's one of the things that your work and Stephanie's work have in common.
Sure. I mean, I totally vibe with that. And one thing I think about is like, and then as that relates to your real life, not just your art. It's like,
right,
you don't have to take too big a step to the side to change your life completely. I mean, it just takes a little shift in your focus, and I think that's perhaps an interesting thing with a lot of art, and especially our art, is saying, okay, how about looking at it a little differently? And
so then do you think
that opens up a whole another parallel universe that you can go live in.
Yeah, so that you can go live in, right? It opens up more space. So Stephanie, you speak, so you, I guess this rolls into Stephanie speaking about the absurd in her work. I want to ask all of you to comment on this. Do you think that this absurd, do you think that this is a conceit for a larger, it sounds to me like you do, for a larger psychological statement or philosophy, or do you want it to end at formalism, Stephanie? Do you think it is possible for any artwork to end at just form, or are there necessarily real-life implications? And before you answer the question, I don't want, because I know this is going to roll into some long answer that is going to be really interesting and spin off, but this question comes in on Twitter. How do the artists feel about the real core of their work being anchored in ideas? Are the materials just traces of the ideas? So the reason I wanted to...
Can you say that again? Sorry.
How do these artists feel about the real core of their work being anchored in ideas? Are the materials just traces of the ideas? In other words, are they artifacts of ideas? Or, as I was asking you, do you want it to end at formalism? Stephanie, do you want to answer that first?
Yeah, I could get really deep into this, but...
I want everyone to touch on it, start.
First. First of all, I would say, yeah, I think there is work that's purely formal. I mean, I have colleagues that are interested in producing work that, you know, just is that truth to materials and is purely... as it is. That's not my way, and I think we've all sort of, I think we can agree on this, that we all are definitely into process and the absurd and the, as I said before, the hypothetical or the untested. What you brought up goes right back to Plato, you know, the idea of idea and form. I mean, these are two things that we've dealt with for so long. I think maybe one of you guys can pick up from here, because
for me, the thing that I sculpt is internal. Are the ideas, and I spend maybe as much time as somebody would. Drawing a form out of a material like a clay or wood or something like this, I do the same, drawing a form out of my thoughts and inspirations and ideas. And for me, this is the initial thing. I don't begin with an object unless this is a very specific prompt we're talking about. And go about trying to transform it, but I begin with an idea that has these and these ramifications and references and things I want to touch on, and then I go about translation. It's an act of translation for me, and even when an object or a performance or something is realized, to me, it will never be as good as the idea, and it's an interesting thing to struggle with as an artist, because no one can ever get it as well as I got it, or can experience it the way I did.
Yeah, I agree with both of you, but I also have a little bit of a different take on it. Maybe is that I think as a visual artist, you can't totally deny the object you're making, because I mean, otherwise you would just be a writer or a poet, or so there is some intrinsic worth to what you're creating. I think otherwise you wouldn't spend the time doing it, if that's what the person is asking. So and I think our work is like, and Ian's a little on the further on the other side, but I think our work is conceptual, but it's definitely rooted in very traditional sound, like practices. I mean, it's like it's sculpture, it's collage, it's photography, it's painting. I mean, so there definitely it's idea driven, but it's not so far removed from the concrete works of art that you can just dismiss that completely. And
I think that's an interesting point, James. Which makes me want to bring up that I did begin, I guess, the field of creative endeavors, and still operate mostly in writing, in using text. So that, I mean, for me, there might be more of that inclination towards the poetic that you mentioned.
Yeah.
Well, and there's always going to be a give and take. I mean, I find for me, some ideas start with a material or an object, and some ideas start as a thought in my head. And then, you know, I'll mix that thought in my head with an object, and there'll be the back and forth conversation that I'm having with this material. So it's a constant, it's as, you know, as we've talked about, there's a fluidity and a organic growth that takes place with both idea and material, that it's this constant back and forth.
Yeah.
Which is exciting. I mean, that's why we do it, right? Because you don't know where it's going to go. And wrap it up there.
No, I think this discussion went really great. I don't think we have any more questions coming in from the audience. And we, believe it or not, it's now an hour. Our time is up. Thank you so much for joining us, Stephanie, Ian, and James. It's been a pleasure, and the conversation was really candid. To our audience thank you for being here tonight. For our audience, if you're in the DC area or on the East Coast US next week, you can see all three of these artists' work, as well as the seven other artists that will be in our in the ARC and NLS presentation at Emerge in room 212. Thank you for tuning in tonight, and join us again tomorrow for the final conversation in this series with Onika Russell, Mark King, and Annabel Vasquez Rodriguez. Like all episodes of In, our conversation tonight is archived on our YouTube channel, so you can go reference it anytime or share the link. And thanks again, guys.
Thank
Have a great
so
night.
Much.
Thanks.
Good night, everyone.
Night.
Amen.